Gerald Visner says he is a writer living in the postmodern era. He sees the world as his text. And he says a good story is an act of liberation for the mind. Gerald Visner is also a member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe. His forebears were the people of the crane, a gregarious tribal bird, he writes, that soars, walks, leaps, and dances. The people of the crane possess naturally a loud ringing voice and are the acknowledged orators of the tribe. For KUAC FM in Fairbanks, this is Conversations, and I'm Susan McGinnis. Today we welcome storyteller, novelist, poet, and professor Gerald Visner. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm really pleased to be here.
The first thing I want to ask you about is the phrase postmodern era, because I think it imbues so much of your writing. What does it mean to you? What are we living in?
Well, we're living in a time when the simulations of reality are more real than the real.
Means?
Well, it means that things that aren't connected or have no connection to real things, such as video images or advertising symbols or values that are sold and consumed, have such a profound reality in our lives. I mean, good ones in many cases and probably dangerous ones in some other cases. But even so, it's very postmodern. It's fast consumer demand, and symbols are generated even more super real than last year's. And so we live on the edge of this kind of postmodern or simulated civilization.
The era of hyperbole.
Yes. Yeah. In tribal experience or Native American experience, and in literature about tribes, I'm arguing postmodern in a little different way. I'm pointing out that there is, there are some conditions that cause us to think the contemporary tribal world is really very postmodern. I mean, I only need mention bingo as a kind of act of survival on reservations, mm-hmm. you know, where the federal government has failed for 1,000 years or whatever amount of time they've been putting into this. And in a decade, bingo has transformed many Indian communities, and for the better. I mean, established scholarships, health programs, paved roads, built housing. I mean, an incredible revolution through bingo. Who would have thought, in a postmodern sense, that white people would drive to reservations to play bingo and support them? They wouldn't pay the taxes to do it, but they'll happily lose at bingo to do it.
In your thinking, then, is everything out of whack? Hallucinogenic mm-hmm. in well, the time in which we live?
Yeah, that's one idea of it, and that certainly trying to grasp the bits and pieces of what's real and what makes a difference, you know, is that feeling, and it certainly feels postmodern, if that's a good word for that. But mm-hmm. I'm thinking about this, that in tribal experience, we're obligated to a sense of postmodern literature because most of what's tribal in the world that's consumed is in translation. Anything in translation is immediately postmodern. I mean, it's not what it is. It's something else. And it's always something else in someone else's terms or someone else's language or someone else's value, like a museum. I mean, who wants to end up in a museum? Mm. Who wants to end up in an archaeology laboratory? You know, I mean, who wants to end up like an artifact? And who wants to go find out who they were in these colonial museums? As beautiful and as powerful as museums are, I'm just pointing out that they're a different organization of reality, and they present a simulated artifact reality of tribal cultures, and that's not who anybody is. You know, that's what people think something might be. That's not who we are. In literature, the translation part of it is really complicated, and I think that tribal storytellers and writers can work right into that without resisting it. I mean, to imagine themselves where they are with what they have and what they understand by inspiration of their own tribal experience, and do it in a very imaginative, postmodern way.
And then weave those stories through the world that lies around you without much fantasy needed.
Yes. Right. Yeah, I mean, the fantasy exists everywhere.
We're talking with Gerald Visner. You're listening to Conversations, if you've just tuned in. Gerald Visner is a professor of English and David Byrd Chair of Letters at the University of Oklahoma, formerly professor of literature at Santa Cruz. He's also a journalist, an essayist, a poet, a screenwriter. a lecturer and was a reporter and an editorial writer years ago for the Minneapolis Tribune. Gerald Visner on Conversations. You've been described as the writer as trickster. Does that have meaning for you, and what does that mean, the writer as trickster?
I'm not sure quite what it means. I don't resist the praise. I assume that's almost always what it is. I mean, it's very playful and it's a generous thought. Tricksters are healers and confronters and restorers and breakthroughers and invitations to humor. And I'm particularly drawn to the power of trickster imagination as an act of healing and liberation. What I mean by healing is, not Band-Aids, but when humor and spiritual ecstasies are inspired by anything, they have healing power. And so a good story kind of liberates the mind in a kind of language game, a play, a humor. A moment of pleasure certainly is healing in the broadest sense of the word. But I have to point out that tricksters are not real people. And tricksters are not representational. Surely if human beings were tricksters, and if a trickster could be represented in the world in some way, either by picture or by voice or by action, there'd be no power left in the trickster. The trickster would be totally corrupted, totally consumed and owned and marketed in some way to bring somebody wealth. But tricksters are acts of imagination. They arise only in imagination, and they're figurations. They really are the evidence of a superior literary imagination among tribal cultures. I am convinced that Western literature, American literature, lacks this great achievement in narrative power, this great achievement to think of a story and imagine a character, an imaginative presentation of a character who transforms and liberates the moment and gives listeners and tellers an instance of pleasure, and it's healing and liberating. I mean, not much literature does that. Mm-hmm. Literature is profound and beautiful and often a great burden, and it's discussed. Mm-hmm. And tricksters don't exist. That's what's wonderful. You can't find one. You can't quote one. You can't represent one. And tricksters and stories never amount to anything. They're always ambivalent. They're totally corrupt and uncorrupting. At the end of a story, whatever it is they might have gained by wit, play, and outrage, it doesn't amount to anything. It doesn't mean anything. They have no political power. They have no ultimate spiritual significance. They don't exist in the end. Nothing happens in the end.
And so what is left?
The pleasure of the play. If the character, the trickster character, that's what I mean about what a brilliant literary act the trickster is in tribal imagination, because it's such a figure that represents nothing. It just represents the play of the story. What it is a language game. And I dare say many people are reluctant to engage in language games. Imagine how reluctant most intellectuals or academics are. They want to be serious. There's power in tenure and there's power in promotion. And if you fool around with that by language games, it kind of upsets the power of that serious game.
You can't laugh at it, find fun in it, make light.
Imagine playing in any way in the seriousness of a courtroom or in any situations of authority. And much of life is like that. But the brilliance of these stories is that people really liberate the moment in a story. I like to think of it in this way. Supposing we were at the moment in an extended family, and we're living in northern Alaska, I'll choose northern Minnesota since I'm speaking mostly about those tricksters in stories. And it's a long and difficult and cold winter, and there's very little food. We're always living with the memory of potential starvation. And if it's too long a winter and too cold a spring, and when we lose access to game, and all of these insecurities. And we're also crammed in a wigwam for 3, 4, 5 months. Can't get out very far anyway. I think we really need a good story to liberate the moment. If we were serious about the problems that we must bear in such a situation, we surely would come up with a good story to liberate the mind, or we would not endure. Now, supposing we're on the interstate in a traffic jam in Los Angeles. The difference is that we're not in a community. It's even worse. It's even worse. We might be shot at. We might be killed in an accident. We might run out of gas and be vandalized. This is Los Angeles. In other words, it's a horrible prospect, and I'm sure most people who drive in the interstates live in constant anxiety of something causing a massive traffic jam that'll take them 3 hours to get out of. There's a place where if there were a really brilliant Western imaginative literary style, that a trickster story should emerge. I mean, a figure that can liberate people on the interstate.
A leavening.
Yes.
Yeah.
Alan Watts used to talk about, you know, the guy who introduces Zen in California.
Mm-hmm.
He encouraged people to shout and be raucous in their cars in traffic jams. He said it was an act of liberation, and it relieved the stress and anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about the same as a character I have in a couple of novels who shouts into the earth. He digs little holes and he shouts into the earth. It's a panic hole. And he's convinced, and there's evidence, that things grow better where he's been shouting. It's a good balance, a restoration of the best energies. And he was so good at this. His voice was so powerfully connected to the earth and restored such a brilliant balance that, in fact, things grew so well that the California Highway Department invited him out during a drought to shout along the medians in the interstates. And sure enough, things grew very well just from the pleasure of his voice. They taped it, of course, and sold it to grow gardens everywhere in the world. But tricksters are not real people, and they're not represented. This isn't a difficulty in other cultures. The Chinese have a monkey king, and the Chinese don't represent it in that consumable way. They don't have any difficulty in their imagination thinking of a trickster as being a figure of imagination rather than some Mickey Mouse that you pay admission to shake hands with and something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And most children, I'm sure, think Mickey Mouse is a real person. I mean, there's a demonstration of simulations that are real. I mean, there is no referent to anything, right? It's this consumer creature made of plastic and other materials.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a kind of reality. I think the story would be much more powerful if there were no representation of Mickey Mouse, if it were just a story rather than a consumable object to buy a shake of the hand or a doll or something, a representation.
Once again, you're listening to Gerald Visner. Your people, at least half your people, come from the people of the Crane.
Yes.
Can you introduce the people of the Crane to us?
Well, there were originally in the stories of Anishinaabe or Chippewa people, in the original stories, the origin stories, there were five basic totems or family organizations or representations of spirit and identity. And one of them was the Crane. And my family was related and descended from that totem, that image, that pleasure of imagination. And others were Bear and Martin, and there are many more totems after that, but of the original five, one of them was the Crane.
Has it felt right to you that a storyteller in the postmodern age has inherited all the gifts from the storytellers, the orators, the cranes from the past?
Imaginatively, I'm connected.
Mm-hmm.
But I should say in real life, there were many disasters and disruptions and disconnections and disassociations. And I've written about that in an autobiography. Mm. And I feel that through imagination and storytelling, I can restore or reconnect some of those values. And that is the power of imagination. That is the power to tell again, to relume, as I speak of it, the imagination of the past. But during the Depression, it was impossible, really, for our families to take much pleasure in these imaginative acts when one was almost exclusively dedicated to food, I mean, to basic survival. It's difficult, you know, to hold people responsible for continuing certain cultural events mm-hmm. and stories, and especially when people have been dislocated and consigned to federal reservations, what I call exclaves, you know, kind of generically. And then those places are very difficult to live in, and especially in Minnesota at that time, and many people moved to the cities to find work, to survive. These were all positive acts. But the connections, the positive acts of survival sometimes appear to be a disillusion of the good connections to tribal identity, because things change. My response to that is that tribal imagination is dramatic, an engagement, an empowerment of real experience and imagination. It's not a static endurance. It's not a permanence somewhere just for the notion of stability or permanence. But tribal cultures have changed and moved forever. Somehow in contemporary Western imagination, tribal cultures must represent as a kind of static entity what they are. I think the difference is this, that tribal people imagine who they are, and that arises from a personal spiritual source within the individual, within a group, within a tribe. It's not external. It's not received from somewhere. I mean, it isn't handed out in a liturgy. It's heard in stories. But the ultimate connections and identity are imagined in the self. They're internal. Those people who study Indians and expect things of them, it's external. It's never really very... It's not a source of imagination. It's a source of comment and description and... a definition and deduction.
The artifact rather than
yes.
the action.
Right, and so it's always external. Mm-hmm. And that's a major separation. I'm not just getting at the idea that, you know, people who study Indians should go live with them. That isn't my point. My point is that everything about tribal experience is imagination, and it arises from people who have this connection or are striving to restore that connection through imagination. Not out of consumable documents that are all external and have no imagination in them. They're only comments.
How did you begin to restore that imagination in yourself? Your autobiography, which is, so people will know, Interior Landscapes by Gerald Visner, Autobiographical Myths and Metaphors is the subtitle, Interior Landscapes. Your early years were what anybody would near call tragic. I mean, very hard. Your father's death when you were just a pup, mm-hmm. your mother's difficulties, foster home, step-parents, mm-hmm. kind of moved from place to place. Some might be happy and some might be dreadful. It seemed to me that a child with shoulders that were not so broad would have turned out just as tragically as the beginning.
I'm kind of amazed myself, actually. But there are a few things that are especially important as I consider the chances which made it possible for me to be here in this way. Mm-hmm. One is that I was never treated with violence, physical violence. And I emphasize that because I've worked in corrections, I worked in delinquency programs, and I worked with a lot of children and adults who suffered so gravely all their lives from violent treatment as children, severe punishment, and just outright acts of violence, physical violence. And I never experienced that. Even in the foster homes, I would witness violence of a foster father to his own children, which he did so sadly in his belief of love and reformation. Mm. He didn't do anything to me because I was only there for the money. Lucky me. Lucky me that I wasn't loved by him. I mean, it's a real contradiction, isn't
it? Yeah, it is.
Okay.
You provided for some of the food on the table, so he wasn't going to endanger you.
It was a haunting contradiction that there but for love, you know, I slipped through. The irony of that, the cruel irony of that, is that that foster home when I was about five or six years old, a boy my age, his biological son, we never saw each other again after that. It was about 2 years I was with them. Until I was about 25, taking my first job out of college, which was a corrections social worker in a state reformatory in Minnesota. And cases came to each caseworker routinely as they were committed to the institution on felony convictions. And in comes a random person. My job is to work up their case, find out if they have any problems or what work are they interested in. This person, on this occasion, is very familiar. We are both haunted by something between us. And we examine every aspect of our potential shared experience, college, high school, military, any experiences we had, came up with nothing. We met several times to try to explore this. Then I was convinced more and more that he was conning me. See, that this was just a big show. He was just conning me, and this was a setup. Only near the end, when I was about to dismiss him with, you know, kind of massive cynicism, we discovered that he was my sort of foster brother for that year. It was a very happy moment, and then turned terribly sad and lonesome because we both recognized instantly but unstated why I was where I was and he was where he was, because of a cruel, very physically punitive father. Really vicious person. But there are many other chances. I was capable of receiving love, and that's important. And I encountered many people who were generous and loving and extended great care and affection to me. And I, for whatever reasons and inspirations or possibilities, I didn't resist it. I mean, sometimes we resist those things or we don't even see them. So that's another aspect of chance that worked in a way that it was positive. I joke with my mother, who I didn't see very much, and probably all told didn't live with her more than probably 3 or 4 years. And it's a little difficult for her at times to take credit for who I am because she didn't have much to do with it. See? So I kid her. It's rough humor, but it's the kind of humor that is liberating because you just, you know, wipe the thing clean and get on with being real people. Mm-hmm. And I kidded her and said, well, imagine how screwed up I'd be if, you know, I'd have been with you. I mean, if you think I've done well, it's only because I wasn't with you. So we might as well both celebrate that.
So be proud.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Stop feeling guilty. Uh-huh. You know, you did a good thing. You got rid of me so I could become somebody.
We're talking with autobiographer and novelist Gerald Visner. In your autobiography and Interior Landscapes, you tell the story of discovering your woodland tricksters. I can't remember. They're in the bed sheets. They're in a...
the little people. Yeah. It was the pleasure of a spontaneous moment of imagination where little people kind of conducted my affairs in secret.
Did you know they were tricksters then, or were they playmates?
Well, they were...
I'm trying to connect the child
I think of
the
them
here.
Later. I mean, I have to think of them as tricksters later. Right. At the time, I just gave them names. They were, you know, personal kind of people. And I joked with them and about and with them, you know, with other people often. I don't mean, you know, I danced them on the table, but I mean, I would fit them into stories. And attribute things to them. For a long time, for example, say, and still do, that I always leave a little food on my table for the little people. Mm. And some people tolerate that, some people don't. Sometimes I use it as an excuse because I don't want to finish eating it, and sometimes I really do play it seriously.
Before we leave your mom, you have a chapter in your book where you give thanks to George Raft.
Yes.
Would you tell this story? Your mother was in love with George Raft. Well, the movies.
Yes. Yeah. Right. Well, it's I'll tell the story, and it's an example of the power of chance. And I give credit to George Raft in the title of this autobiographical story, and I say, thank you, George. And what I mean is that I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be sitting here talking in this moment if not for George Raft in the movies. I asked my mother, as an adult, in fact, when I was working on these autobiographical stories, I asked her, how does a 17-year-old white girl, high school dropout, which she was, how does an unemployed 17-year-old high school dropout meet a reservation Indian? I mean, how does that work during the Depression? I mean, how do you get to that? How does the world come together like that? That's as complicating as wondering, how does a fur trader from France get together with an Indian woman in northern Minnesota? I mean, how does that happen? She said, with just a moment of thought, actually, where she drifted to the occasion, I'm sure, and she said, Jerry, he looked just like George Raft. Well, it was a wonderful moment for me because it reinforced all of the good thoughts I have about chance in life, that things just happen. They don't have clear rational motivation. I mean, supposing she'd have been turned on to some other actor, I'd be some different person.
Right.
And luckily, my father, Clement William Visenor from the White Earth Reservation, looked just like George Raft.
And gave you your life.
That's right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you read a section from the autobiography. There is a, you introduce your forebears in the beginning of the book.
Yes, I refer to my grandmother and associations with the tribal past.
This is Gerald Visenor once again, and he's reading from Interior Landscapes.
Alice Mary Beaulieu, my paternal grandmother, was born more than a century ago on the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. She inherited the crane totem, a natural tribal pose. But we were crossbloods, loose families then at the end of the Depression in the cities. Clement William Visenor, my father, was a crane descendant too. He was born on the reservation and murdered 26 years later on a narrow street in Minneapolis. My tribal grandmother and my father were related to the leaders of the Crane. That succession over a wild background of cedar and concrete, tribal shamans and colonial assassins, is celebrated here in the autobiographical myths and metaphors of my imagination, my crossblood stories and remembrance. We are cranes on the rise in a new tribal narrative. My grandmother did not hear the beat of the crane in the cities during the Depression. She was concerned with other measures of survivance then, those marginal revisions of personal pleasures and familial travail in a cold and secular tenement. My father died in a place no crane would choose to dance, at a time no tribal totem would endure. One generation later, the soul of the crane recurs in my own imagination. This is our reversion, our interior landscapes.
The opening paragraphs of Interior Landscapes, the chapter is called Family of the Crane. And this is Gerald Visenor. You said, and I apologize, I can't remember now whether it was in an article or an interview, but that 30 years ago it was not uncommon to read about tribal people as if they were somnambulant cultural artifacts or uncivilized pagans living on wilderness reservations. Mm-hmm. What do you think 30 years from that time? You look at...
Changes from that time?
Yeah.
Well, I've been active, in organizations and Indian issues for almost 30 years. I mean, about that time. And I started in community organizations and, you know, street work sort of in the generic sense, revolutionary organizations. And 30 years ago, Indians were denied services. Indians were categorized as being incapable of certain forms of occupation. The most active stereotypes surrounded the general intelligence and capabilities of Indians in rational thought. Another popular stereotype at the time, and an extremely negative one, which still lingers with us, but not as dramatically as it did then, and that's the genetic proclivity or predisposition to alcohol, as if Indians had some bad gene that they inherited. These were all terrible consequences of identity and extremely difficult circumstances for individuals to rise above. These were terrible burdens. They were still in newspapers at that time. I mean, there was still gossip and public information, negative advertising, derogatory references to Indians in advertising, cruel and mean and nasty stuff. And since then, there are hundreds of PhDs, many of them teaching in universities, many of them teaching in courses that directly relate to tribal identity, to tribal history, to tribal legal issues, tribal literature. And of all the diverse cultures in the country, trying to bring together some new voice, some new historical methodology, some new legal reasoning, some new literary criticism to advance the outstanding imagination of tribal storytellers, and to challenge the canon that has limited all of this in American experience. And the numbers of Indians in colleges is just overwhelming in 30 years. This is one generation, and just remarkable achievements by people who have worked hard and done good things, and done it with good humor too, with play and affection and good humor. Probably some of the most difficult things that seem at a distance not to have changed are physical conditions on reservations. There's actually been a kind of reversal in public health services, not only for Native Americans in rural areas, but for all Americans, but more severely for the poorest and the most disadvantaged in extreme rural areas and reservations. That's the most discouraging part, I think, and also unemployment, which has actually gotten worse. As if someone had to be born right, meaning class and social standing, to receive proper medical care, is such a disgrace in this country. And everyone should have adequate and proper medical care, not just Indians. And it's difficult to speak about the rights Indians have to services in America, because they traded under duress most of the landscape to the people who made their wealth from resources that were stolen and tricked and obtained by fraud from tribal cultures. And what little remains in treaties and protections of sovereignty almost always announce in these treaties that services will be provided in exchange for, etc. And that's been very difficult. But you see how difficult it is to argue for exclusive or individual medical care just for Indians based on treaties when the whole nation is in such dire need for basic and fundamental health maintenance and care. But apart from the mental health and physical health and some other welfare services for children, I mean, which have all fallen backward really in the past 10 and 20 years, the advances in education and in legal services and in corporate development, tribal corporate development of resources on reservations, all of these areas have really been outstanding improvements. Tribal corporations have made much better use of their own resources at a much higher price and no longer, you know, are in exclusively in the hands of federal agents. So I would say generally the advancements in many areas in the past 30 years have just been outstanding. In other areas, it's actually fallen back, like physical health.
In the realm of America's ongoing battle with racism, how do you think Native Americans are faring under the dominant culture?
There's still a very powerful romantic response to Native Americans as historical figures, demonstrated kindly in the film Dances with Wolves of, you know, most recent time. And many other films have presented very positive romantic tribal scenes and adventures. And these certainly are positive, but they do present Indians as historical figures, I mean, as kind of traditional themes. I'd be more encouraged if, say, urban Indians were in a positive story and, you know, were featured in films that suggested that they were, you know, pretty outstanding human beings in all walks of life and, you know, did this and that. And, but they aren't, because there still is a demand for a kind of artifact presentation of Indians to satisfy a romantic association and need, I guess, in the dominant society.
And the images that we call forth in arts and literature are predominantly the images of our imagination of what's real.
That's right.
Yeah.
The I think the testiest part of it right now is somewhat ongoing, but it's become more acute with the recent census figures about the population, the increase in population of Indians. The ongoing part of it is this, that mixed-blood American Indians have received a particular kind of racist reception from the dominant society. What mixed-bloods must face is that they're incomplete. They're neither here nor there.
Fish nor fowl.
Yeah, and they're not the best of either. You know, they're sort of the worst of both. They have no culture. They're not Indian, and they're not white. That's generally the response from whites.
That's a very peculiar response, since most whites are mongrels.
Yes, I know. I mean, but
Scots, French, German.
See themselves
whatever.
Otherwise. This is a real contradiction, because on the one hand, the popular reception is that if Indians intermarry, they become less Indian. Now, of course, which Indians wouldn't accept. If it's also obviously a racist declension, right? But the irony is this: when blacks intermarry, they seldom, in racist terms, in white racist terms, blacks who intermarry seldom become less black. In other words, white racists look upon blacks as always being black, however mixed the inheritance. When Indians mix, they become more white, less Indian. It's very interesting. It's some peculiar racist investment, I think, in conquest for Indians, that one, they can be conquered in terms of assimilation, and the means of assimilation are various. Intermarriage is one. Well, that just hasn't happened, of course. Blacks, so sadly in American history, our slaves have economic value, and so it doesn't make any difference. They're always of economic value, no matter how much they intermarry. I mean, in that absolute slavery mentality, I think that's part of the origin of this notion that blacks stay black through intermarriage, Indians become white.
We're talking once again. Let me reintroduce you, because I haven't done it in a while. We're talking with Gerald Visner. He is a member of the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, born in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Once again, a professor of English, currently at the University of Oklahoma, formerly with UC Santa Cruz, and upcoming in Berkeley.
Yes.
In the next year or so,
in the fall.
Among his books, Bearheart, The Airship Chronicles, H-E-I-R-S-H-I-P, for people who are not familiar, Bearheart, The Airship Chronicles, Crossbloods, Earth Divers, and Interior Landscapes, which we've discussed, his autobiography. Upcoming, The Heirs of Christopher Columbus will be published by the University of Minnesota in 1991.
Wesleyan University.
And, my apologies.
Be released in June.
All right. The Heirs of Christopher Columbus, to be published by Wesleyan University in 1991. Also a collection of short stories called Stories in the Blood that'll come out this year as well by Wesleyan.
Yes.
Gerald Visner, our guest today on Conversations. It has seemed to me that people who are somehow on the margin of a culture, or of cultures, plural, have, whether they are racially on the margin, through sexual orientation, through gender, have often the eyes to see the culture more clearly because they see it from the boundary. They also take the risk of becoming victimized by their marginality. As a writer, do you see yourself standing on the margin and looking in? Is that the preferred position or natural position for you?
I don't think I've ever seen myself in a margin. Others have seen me that way, but I don't see myself that way. I speak from an experience which is really quite common to a large number of people.
Well, I think many people are on the margin.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge margin.
Right.
In fact, the margin might be the majority.
But it's not seen as the majority.
No, it's not.
It is. The other thing I was thinking of in my question is you tend to, in your stories, write in historical references. Mm-hmm. You quote from other historical references, mm-hmm. or you bring in other writers to talk in your narratives. Most of the history in this nation is pretty white, pretty male, mm-hmm. military, patriotism, mm-hmm. capitalism. But isn't the history of the people, isn't the history of your mama in Minneapolis or my mama in Sacramento. Mm-hmm. When I was reading Interior Landscapes and watching you weave the history of the nation into their lives, mm-hmm. I was wondering which you're making richer, their lives richer for giving them context in the history, or the history, which is really a very slim volume, richer mm-hmm. by weaving in the lives of the people. Your thoughts on that?
It's inescapable. I mean, that there be any separation between, you know, the tribes of the nation and the history of the nation. If the door was closed, I try to open it. And you pass both ways. And I do call upon some contemporary interpretations of history, sometimes for the wrong reasons. I mean, I call them in text for criticism. But I always call upon tribal writers everywhere. And I put tribal writers in the same voice and the same significance as white writers. In fact, often line them up to point out how superior is the insight of tribal writers. Mm-hmm. So I think it is true. I think what I'm trying to do is find readers who will appreciate that tribal and American experience is a discourse of a kind, mm-hmm. and it's complicated. And what's exciting about it is the discourse, is the engagement, and is the contradiction. And that's really what gives it life, gives us energy, and gives us some pleasure and imagination, is an attempt to understand the complications and difficulties of all these categories that are imposed upon us. It isn't rewriting or revising history, but it's placing people in circumstances that might have otherwise been interpreted as overwhelming them. And I don't believe it overwhelmed them. I believe they became better people by it.
Stronger, fuller, yep, for having fought the depression.
Not victims. No, yeah. And so often, social science interpretations would look upon members of my family as victims. I don't. They don't. We won't. I mean, we aren't. And so to write about it, I want to show how we're not. Difficult, complicated, terrible experiences, but never victims. And always with the pleasure of humor, good stories, imagination. I think there's one moment in the autobiography where I point out that my grandmother lived with her children, I mean, it was very crowded, and me, in a crowded, cold water tenement, where, you know, when people were trying to find work, my uncles, my aunts, my grandmother, she cared for this whole family, they worked together. It was a wonderful, warm environment. Less than 10 miles away, F. Scott Fitzgerald was dining and taking pleasure in his class experience in St. Paul and writing his books. But I've read his books. I've read tribal books. I've heard my family tell stories. And I have no difficulty saying that the stories the members of my family told are far better literature than what F. Scott Fitzgerald was praised for. And yet we live 10 miles apart. So what I do in that story is bring us together in the same universe, which some people may not have put us in. And at the same time Fitzgerald was drinking quality wine and having an audience, so were my relatives. And they had a good audience. They told stories that liberated the mind and made us better people. So did F. Scott Fitzgerald.
In context. Gerald Visner, would you tell us about the new book?
The Heirs of Columbus is probably the first story about Columbus that's told from a tribal point of view. Not only tribal, but genetic. Mayan tribal people sailed east to the Mediterranean and North Africa and intermarried in time long before Christ with, see, I'm rewriting history here.
Right.
Long before Christ with spice traders and other interested and adventurous people in the Middle East and North Africa. And as a result, Jesus Christ, Christopher Columbus, Sephardic Jews, and many others are Mayan Indians, mixed bloods, cross bloods. Christopher Columbus bears a signature, a genetic signature of survivance. It's a healing signature in his genes. And he bears this as a cross-blood Mayan and returns to the New World. And all of this is told in a tribal context. In other words, it's the first time that Indians in a story have imagined who Columbus is. They take into account his history as it's reported and as he tells of it in his own journal, but they know who he is by their own imagination. Well, my storytellers, the principal characters of the novel, they've inherited this genetic signature, and it comes to them through Christopher Columbus in the New World. My character in contemporary time is Stone Columbus. He's a healer. He has this genetic signature. It's delightfully crazy. And he makes a fortune on a bingo barge in Lake of the Woods. It's important that he make a fortune on bingo because his next significant act in the novel is to found a new nation, a new sovereign state, the first in the history of the world, dedicated exclusively to healing people. And millions of children swim and hobble and crawl and walk and sing from all over the world on their way to this sacred place to be healed. These children, sadly, are the mutants of our chemical civilization. And Stone Columbus has the money and the power and the genetic signature. Scientists replicate it. The children receive a genetic implant. They're healed by the sacred shamanic power of the Mayans. And it's a better world. In the end, however, there's a showdown in very traditional terms of story, and that's between the Wendigo, the great water monster, the cannibal, who in a traditional story had a game, a moccasin game with the tribe, and the winner would take all. And the Wendigo never lost, and until he met the trickster, and the trickster outwitted him and saved the tribe.
So there is a happy ending.
Yep. And in this case, I won't tell you what happens at the New Nation, but there is a moccasin game, and the Wendigo is very powerful. Actually, there had been a second moccasin game where, in tribal history, where the tribe called upon the ice woman who froze the Wendigo in mid-choice in the game. He was about to win, and he ended up being frozen. So he was held in an ice cave by this powerful ice woman. But federal agents of the United States government, as a way to destroy this new healing nation, this new sovereign state of tribal people, they thought out the Wendigo and sent him into action. Sounds almost like real life, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Patriot missile.
But at any rate, they make a proposal to him in the game that he can't resist.
And this is the story, The Heirs of Christopher Columbus, to be published in 1991, June thereof, by Wesleyan University Press. Its author is Gerald Visner. You've written about what you call bone courts.
Yes.
And I'd be very interested to know, to have you tell us about a bone court. It is that the constitutional rights don't end, yes, is
yes,
the theory?
Yes, that's right. There, in an essay entitled Bone Courts, I propose a new court established in the federal judiciary that would hear cases arising from human remains. Wherever human remains are exposed for whatever reasons, unearthed in a construction site, overturned at the edge of a cliff, cemeteries, museums, Smithsonian Institution, wherever, all human remains, and not just tribal, that the remains, the individual remains, have a right to representation in this federal bone court. In other words, they have a right to be heard, to have representation in the form of a lawyer who would argue on behalf of the human remains. The other thing that's necessary is to accept the fact that human remains have legal standing. That's an issue that was raised brilliantly by Christopher Stone many years ago in response to a proposal by a corporation to build a theme park in the Sierras, and Christopher Stone argued in a brief that trees should have legal standing. That is, the trees have a right to be there, and they should have some standing in court. But living things are rarely ever, other than humans, are rarely ever recognized, other life forms rarely ever recognized as having standing in court, unless they're owned by someone. And then it's a loss to the person, right? Not the tree doesn't have a right, but someone who owns it does. Well, Stone argued that corporations are not real things, and they're fictions, and they have rights. Universities do, ships at sea, right? Municipal governments, all these abstracts, unborn children, you know, are not real living things. And they're fictions, and they have legal rights. So it's perfectly reasonable to allow other entities, other living forms. And I extend that to human remains. I strengthen my argument in this way, that there's nothing I've found in constitutional theory or interpretations of the Bill of Rights that suggest that human rights in the Bill of Rights and the Constitution of the United States end at death. There's nothing that says that. So I assume clearly, on the basis of constitutional rights and interpretations of the Bill of Rights, that the protections were accorded as citizens extend forever. They don't end at death. In other words, death is not the last word. I still have my rights. Moreover, people are buried with ceremonial care. We intend the people we've loved to be protected and their rights should stand. We intend that. We show that in our reverence. Therefore, Indians held in museums, like criminals, their remains are detained in these cases, in the interests of science, have no rights, have no standing. My argument is that in a federal court, a bone court, a lawyer would argue on behalf of these remains. These remains would have legal standing. One could bring in witnesses to tell the stories of these remains. What a wonderful source of narratives about tribal people, tribal cultures, human remains.
This sounds almost possible.
Yes, of course it is.
Lovely. I believe it's somewhere in your past that you quoted a lawyer who said that if you dig up the bones of a white person, you go to jail.
Yes.
If you dig up the bones of an Indian, they give you a PhD.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the tropes to power in anthropology and other social sciences are to study Indians. I mean, you get power out of studying Indians. You get power out of Indian remains. You go to jail on white remains.
More power to you, Gerald Visner.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you for joining me today in Conversations. Once again, if you've got your pencils out, the new book coming out, there are two, The Heirs of Christopher Columbus, to be published by Wesleyan University Press, June of 1991. Also, a collection of short stories comes out this year, Stories in the Blood by Wesleyan University Press. Another book, first published in 1976, Bearheart, about the world after we run out of petroleum. Might read that one again. And Crossbloods came out since then. Also, the autobiography we have mentioned, Interior Landscapes, Autobiographical Myths and Metaphors. Gerald Visner is professor of English and the David Burr Chair of Letters at the University of Oklahoma, soon to be found at the University of California at Berkeley. I'm Susan McGinnis. This has been Conversations, a conversation today with Gerald Visner. Thanks very much. We'll talk to you again next week.
Thanks very much.